Well, we are continuing our study here, our trip, our road trip through the 66 books of the Bible. Route 66, we've called it, because there's 66 books in the Bible. And we've been giving thought to some of the major overarching themes. It's very different than how we normally would carry out a preaching series. I mean, usually we're going to work through a book of the Bible and go through verse by verse, a small section, and seek to understand and apply that text. But in this series, we're getting a really unique perspective of Scripture from 30,000 feet. We are looking at entire books of the Bible in one message. And today, we're going to be considering the book of Numbers. So just to kind of set the stage again for us, we're only four books in. Here's our bookshelf with those 66 books. Top left corner is that little orange stack that are often called the books of Moses, the books of the law, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And they are a five-volume series. They're interconnected. They tell one cohesive story of God's redemptive plan. And of course, just because of where they're at in the canon, in the scriptures, they have tremendous significance. They lay the foundation for all that will follow. So we've been trying to make sure we get that good foundation in place. So just to kind of set the stage for us again, Genesis tells us about creation, the fall of humanity into sin. Genesis also tells us about God's rescue plan for humanity. So Genesis is key. It explains why the world is the way it is, why there's cancer, why there's death, why there's aging, why there's divorce. It's because sin has entered into the world, and death has come as a result of sin. But even in the wake of Genesis and the fall, we have God's grace. We have a pronouncement of salvation, even in Genesis 3, verse 15. And ultimately, God puts his plan in motion by calling out Abraham from an idol-worshipping family, and he makes a covenant with Abraham and with Abraham's descendants. And he says, Abraham, I'm gonna bless you. I'm going to make of you a great nation. I am going to give you your own land. And ultimately, I am going to bless all the nations of the earth through you and your descendants. So Abraham's at the center of that plan. And God just shows his continued covenant faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants. So as we come into Exodus, we find Abraham and his descendants, or Abraham's descendants, in Egypt, enslaved, in bondage, crying out for help. And God, again, in his covenant love, delivers them out of Egypt with a mighty hand, delivers them through the Red Sea, and then and brings them to Mount Sinai, where he gives them his law. He reiterates his intentions for them, his purposes for them, to make of them a distinct people. So he gives them his law, his instructions, how he wants them to live. He instructs them how to build a tabernacle, a tent, where he will, in some way, show up in their midst, right? He'll manifest his presence somehow in that tent. And that leads us to Leviticus, because in Leviticus, they deal with the problem of God's holiness. There's a tent, and God dwells in the tent, but they can't enter the tent because of their sin. And so Leviticus is all about atonement. How can a person make atonement for their sin in such a way that they're able to enter into the presence of a holy God? So that's laid out for us there in Leviticus, and here Numbers picks up there at Mount Sinai. That's where we're heading today. There was still something awaiting God's people, right? He had promised them a land, and right now they're just nomads. And so the next step here in Numbers, we begin to be introduced to the land that God is going to give them. I read this quote. It was kind of discouraging this week. It says, the book of Numbers almost defies dissection into logical literary units, making it perhaps the most difficult Old Testament book in which to identify order and structure. That did not bode well for my week, okay, to realize that Numbers is kind of difficult to categorize. But I think there's at least a really simple outline that I'm going to give you to help you understand it. It's a two-part outline, and each movement is connected to a place and a particular group of people, okay? And there's two key places and two groups of people that are addressed here in Numbers. So we'll kind of walk through it briefly, and then I'm gonna draw some concluding lessons that I want to make sure we walk away with some takeaways this morning, and then we'll close looking at Christ and just looking at how Numbers gives us a glimpse of the gospel. Okay, so that'll be our approach. So the first place is Kadesh, and the first group of people is what I'm calling the first generation. Right, and this encompasses chapters 1 through 20 of the book of Numbers. The first section here is filled with what I call freedom and blessing. It's really positive. There's excitement in the air. I think you're going to be able to see that as we move through. The community is being organized now, right? This is not just a ragtag bunch of freed slaves wandering about the wilderness, but now they're being organized together in some meaningful way. Matter of fact, we start off in Numbers chapter 1 with a census being taken. So they begin to count all the people and the various tribes and begin to organize themselves. That's actually where Numbers gets its name, is the numbering of the people. So the people are numbered and organized. They're given a lot of instructions even about how they are to camp. So you have, here's kind of a visual of what's described in the opening chapters here. The tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, is in the middle. That's significant, isn't it? Because God's presence was going to be at the heart of the nation. And outside or around the tabernacle was where the Levites would camp. They were the one tribe that was responsible for things of the tabernacle, for helping with the sacrifices, for carrying around all the furniture and the Ark of the Covenant. When the tent had to be taken down, they were the ones that were responsible to take it down and pack it up. And things were to be carried in certain ways. Some things could be carried on carts, but the Ark of the Covenant had to be carried on long poles. And so all these instructions were committed to the Levites. So they were right in there around the tabernacle, kind of a buffer, as it were, between the rest of the people and the tabernacle itself. So just instructive how God laid out how they were to set up camp and communicating his central presence among his people. There's a dedication ceremony in chapters 7 and 8 that has to do with the tabernacle or the tent of meeting. And they begin to settle into sort of normal rhythms of life. They actually celebrate in chapter 9 the first Passover since their deliverance out of Egypt. So you will remember that the last plague when they were in Egypt was the death of the firstborn. And all the firstborn of both people and animals in Egypt would die as part of God's judgment. But God instructed the Israelites to slaughter a lamb and to put the blood of that lamb over the doorpost. And in that way, the angel of death would pass over them. And so they were to celebrate that every year. And this was the one-year anniversary. They get to stop and remember again God's great deliverance. This was kind of their Independence Day. This was like 4th of July for them, right? And they thought about how God had freed them. On the day that the tabernacle was set up and consecrated, we're told that God's presence settled on the tabernacle. Numbers chapter 9, verse 15. On the day the tabernacle, the tent of the covenant law, was set up, the cloud covered it. From evening till morning, the cloud above the tabernacle looked like fire. That is how it continued to be. The cloud covered it, and at night it looked like fire. Whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent, the Israelites would set out. Whenever the cloud settled, the Israelites encamped. At the Lord's command, the Israelites set out, and at his command, they encamped. So it's this wonderful picture of God present with his people. He's leading them. He's guiding them. So when that cloud lifts from over the tent and begins to move, the people begin to pack up their things and they follow God's lead. And when that cloud stops, they set up camp. You can sense the excitement that would have characterized the people here. At the end of chapter 10, they actually set out. So now finally, they leave Mount Sinai, where they've received all the instructions, and they begin to make their way towards the land that God had promised them. Numbers 10:33. So they set out from the mountain of the Lord and traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find them a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, Lord. May your enemies be scattered. May your foes flee before you." Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." So God's presence, God was on the move, right? And they are finally setting out to receive all the blessings that God had promised them. It's within this section that Aaron, the priest, was given the great Shema, the great Hebrew blessing. It's recorded here in chapter 6, verse 22. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, 'The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace.' So they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them." To me, that verse just captures what these opening chapters are all about. People living with God in their midst and experiencing his provision and protection and guidance and blessing. But of course, it doesn't last, does it? We find a season now of disobedience and disappointment, and it didn't take long. Notice verse chapter 11. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So they were complaining. They were grumbling, right? This is characteristic of the people of Israel. They began their 160-mile journey to Kadesh, to the border of the promised land. But within 3 days of beginning the journey, they begin to complain about their hardship. And we're told that the Lord was angry, probably because they didn't have anything to complain about. There's nothing to complain about here. They are experiencing God's blessing. Maybe there was a little blister there, you know, from 3 days of walking. But they're complaining already, having lost sight of God's grace and his provision and his salvation. At least one of the things that was on their mind, if we read on here in chapter 11, was food. They had a craving. Taco Bell. Oh, no, it wasn't Taco Bell. But God had provided manna, this bread-like wafer substance that would come down on the ground each day, supernaturally provided for a million people. But 3 days in, they were tired of manna. They wanted something else on the menu, right? They wanted meat. And so God does providentially provide for them, but he provides quail, more than they could ever eat in a lifetime. And God's judgment actually comes upon the people because of their greed and their insatiable craving. So that's certainly one scene here in chapter 11. There's also another ugly scene in chapter 12, and it had to do with Miriam and Aaron. Now remember, Moses, Miriam, and Aaron were siblings. So they had a close family relationship. Miriam and Aaron were seemingly given positions of influence within the community of Israel. Aaron, of course, was made priest. But Miriam and Aaron began chafing under Moses' leadership. Notice what it says here in Numbers 12. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses?" they asked. "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" And the Lord heard this. So Moses had married a black African woman, a Cushite, which is southern Ethiopia, maybe even into Sudan. Very dark skin. And in some sense, Miriam in particular seemed to think that this reflected a character flaw in Moses. She kind of needles at this and began to make this an issue. And boy, does God ever set her straight. Wow. I mean, God rebukes both her insubordination, her unwillingness to follow Moses' leadership, and also her racism, all in one fell swoop, doesn't he? And the punishment that is levied on Miriam is stark and graphic. God gives her leprosy. And it's a very interesting description here if we were to read through the text. It's almost as if God says to Miriam, "So you think light skin is superior? Then I'm going to make your skin as white as snow. I'm going to give you leprosy." But there's this restlessness, this discontent that's going on here. Certainly in the lives of the people at large, within the community, but even in the lives of Miriam and Aaron. They already had positions of influence within the community, but they wanted more. And obviously it led to great sorrow and regret. This is all building up to the real tragedy of unbelief here in chapters 13 and 14. And of course, it had to do with the spies. So they've arrived at Kadesh. I said Kadesh was going to be the location you got to lock onto for this group of people, for this first generation. Kadesh was right there on the southern border of the Promised Land, the southern border of Canaan. And when they got to that point, Moses said, God said, "I want you to send in 12 spies. Choose a representative from each of the 12 tribes of Israel and send them in on a reconnaissance mission. I want you to just sort of get the lay of the land and understand where the major cities are located. And I want you to bring back some of the food. Don't forget the food, because this is a very lush, prosperous land." And so the 12 spies were chosen and the 12 spies went out. But notice what happened when they returned with their report. Numbers 13, verse 25. "At the end of 40 days, the spies returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account: 'We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan.' Then Caleb silenced the people." Caleb's one of the 12 spies. "Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.' But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are.' And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, 'The land we explored devours those living in it. The people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in their eyes, and we looked the same to them.'" They were asked to just simply bring back a report of the cities and bring back some fruit, and instead, unfortunately, they brought back their opinions. Right? 10 of the spies chose to focus on the difficulties. Only Joshua and Caleb expressed confidence in the promises of God and suggested that they should proceed. If we were to read on, we'd see the people rise up against Moses in unison and say, "You know, we're not going in." And of course, the sad result was that that entire generation would not enter the promised land. God determined that they would die in the wilderness. He would not let them enter the land of his blessing. We actually enter into a 40-year period. It goes rather quickly when you read Numbers. You don't realize it. You don't have the sense of gravity that 40 years are going by. That entire generation is dying in the wilderness. But it's a season of tremendous regret. It's a sobering season to think of lost opportunities. It culminates here in chapter 20, especially with what I just call some hard lessons. Center on Miriam and Moses and Aaron. We're told here in chapter 20 that Miriam died. Well, this happened again at the end of the 40 years. That whole generation is passing away, including Miriam, without the opportunity to enter into the promised land. And then one of the more sobering accounts here of Moses in Numbers 20, beginning in verse 2. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this wilderness that we and our livestock should die there? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together, speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community, so they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them." So God said, "Speak to the rock." And in a fit of anger, Moses struck the rock. And not before he called the people a few names and seemingly took credit for this miracle. "Must we bring you water out from the rock?" As if Moses was doing the heavy lifting, right? God says, "We get it. I get Moses' anger, right? The people are complaining. Why did you lead us out here into the wilderness?" And if you're Moses, you're like, "Hello? Look in the mirror. I didn't lead you out here. It was your own lack of faith, your own disobedience that landed you out here in the wilderness for these 40 years." So we get Moses' anger, but it was still a serious sin. Moses directly disobeyed the Lord's command in front of the people. He failed to honor God before the people. So Moses, too, is told he's not going to enter the land. And then at the close here of chapter 20, it's Aaron. Aaron, the priest, now dies. And specifically, it draws attention to the fact that he dies without entering the promised land. So hard lessons, a lot of regret, lost opportunities represented here in this 40-year wilderness wandering. That's the first half of the book up through chapter 20. But there's a second group and a second location that is really the focus of verses 21 through 36. It's what I'm calling the second generation. And it really centers here in Moab. There's what I call another exodus here. So remember, the first generation of people, including Miriam and Aaron, Moses is still alive at this point, but that entire generation has now died. There's a new generation that has come on the scene, the children of those people. And it's almost as if there's another exodus. And what I mean by that is this, that first generation was delivered out of Egypt. They saw God's great power and might. They had every reason to trust him, right, when they came to the border of the promised land. But they didn't. But now a new generation has risen up. Maybe these were just young children, or maybe not even born when God delivered that first generation out of Egypt. But God shows his power to this new generation too. That's why I call it another Exodus. He delivers them with a strong and mighty hand. And in these chapters, you see nations around them. The king of Arad, the king of Sihon, the king of Og, these surrounding nations that all attack Israel. I mean, Israel's just pretty helpless, right? They don't have weapons. They've been a slave people. And they're sitting ducks out there. And these nations keep attacking them. And God providentially preserves them and gives them victory over their enemies. They fall into sin. But again, God even delivers them from that. Chapter 21, verse 4. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there's no water. We detest this miserable food." Verse 6, then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. So they saw God deliver them from their enemies, from military armies. They saw God deliver them even from their own sin and selfish choices. And then there's a really interesting account here of Balak, the king of Moab. Balak doesn't like the Israelites. He's afraid of them. But he's watched these other nations try to attack them and without success. And so Balak says, "I can't defeat them with my military. Perhaps I can somehow defeat them in the spiritual realm. We'll call down a curse on these Israelites," right? And this is where the account comes in of Balaam, a local prophet. Balak says, "I want to hire you, Balaam, to pronounce a curse on these people." And so Balaam sets out, loads up his donkey, heads down the road with Balak. And you remember that God puts an angel in front of the donkey, right? He blocks the road. Balaam can't see the donkey. Matter of fact, he's getting upset. He's kicking his donkey. "Come on, let's go." Finally, God allows the donkey to turn around and rebuke Balaam. Right? And Balaam's eyes were opened, and he realized, "I'm not going anywhere, and I'm not saying anything that God doesn't want me to say." And Balaam stands up there with Balak, looks out over the people of Israel, prepares to speak his curse, and yet he only speaks a blessing. Three times. So God shows his power even over the spiritual realm here in that whole account of Balaam. By the way, it's interesting to look at all the enemies that come against Israel. Their real problem, as outlined in Numbers 25, was not out there, but inside the community. They end up falling into sexual sin, and God has to bring his own judgment against them. But there's this what I'm calling a second Exodus, that God shows his power to this new generation. There's a recount. I told you again that Numbers gets its name because there was a census taken of the people in chapter 1. But that, remember, was a counting or a census of the first generation. Those people are all gone now. So it's interesting, when you come to Numbers 26, there's a second census. There's a second numbering of the people. It's new people. There's a refresher course. This new generation, again, was quite young when, or maybe not even alive yet, when the first generation was at Mount Sinai receiving all the instructions. So God walks through again his instructions about sacrifices, about holy living, about how they're to treat one another. All of these things, a refresher course for this new generation. And then we come to what I call the moment of truth again. So the first generation was at Kadesh, the southern border of the Promised Land. They're right there. They can see it. They can taste it. And they fall back in unbelief, right, and wander for 40 years. God now brings the second generation to Moab, slightly different location, not the southern border, but now the southeastern border of the Promised Land. Up on a high location, they can look out, they can see the entire land of Canaan. They stand once again at this point. And that's kind of where Numbers ends. Like, what are they going to do? Is the outcome going to be different from what happened with the first generation? Have they learned their lesson? Are they going to respond in faith? The giants are still in the land. All the enemies are still there. Are these people going to make the same mistake that the first generation did? By the way, that kind of a literary approach kind of leaves us hanging, and it leaves us questioning a little bit, doesn't it? Like, what are they going to do? And before long, I'm thinking, what would I do? where do I fall in this? There's a tension there in the text that Numbers leaves us with. Well, a couple of lessons here to kind of draw together some summarizing thoughts. Number one, guard your heart. Guard your heart. Salvation does not exempt us from the dangers of sin and its devastating consequences. Remember, these people had been delivered out of Egypt. They, in that sense, had been saved. But they did not experience God's blessing. They did not experience all that God had for them. They got off track because of their sin. They missed out on so much that God had for them. We can grow up, I grew up hearing the scriptures. Maybe you're newer to the faith, but when we've heard the scriptures for any length of time, sometimes we can become a little callous to it, can't we? We can, oh yeah, I read that passage before. I start thinking ahead to this or whatever, and it doesn't hit us like it used to. Our hearts can become hard, our consciences can become seared. And this is one of the lessons that we are to learn here from the wilderness wanderings. 1 Corinthians 10, Paul writes, "For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." So they experienced God's salvation, right? Verse 3, "They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." That's what he's describing. That generation of people who rejected God and died in the wilderness. Notice what he says here. "Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 of them died." In Hebrews, the same thing. "So as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of testing in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested and tried me, though for 40 years they saw what I did. This is why I was angry with that generation. I said, their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest." Both of those passages, reflecting on this period of time, say that this is an example, this is a cautionary tale, that we must not allow our hearts to become hardened. Guard your heart. And my brothers and sisters, the longer you've been a believer, the more prone we are to have hard hearts. Should be just the opposite. But we sometimes fail to see our sin for what it is, and we forget about the amazing nature of God's salvation and his redemption. Guard your heart. Cultivate a spirit of gratitude. It's hard to miss, if you read Numbers, it's hard to miss the grumbling, the complaining. I mean, just chronic. And I just was thinking about that too, even as the starting point. If you go back to chapter 11, that's like where it began for them. There's a lot of really bad sins that ended up happening within the community, but it started with this grumbling spirit. Need some meat, you know, why do we keep eating this manna 3 days in a row? And that type of a spirit led them to a really bad place. Paul addresses it with the church: do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure children of God without fault. This is part of the distinctive nature of God's people. We ought to be a people of gratitude. And gratitude is an antidote to bitterness and anger and discontent. That's why it's so important to do what we did today and talking together and singing of God's faithfulness. So cultivate a spirit of gratitude. Let's hit this at its root, this whole issue of discontent. Finally, don't waste your wilderness experiences. Don't waste your wilderness experiences. God often uses wilderness experiences to test us, to get our attention, to teach us. These are painful experiences. They're not pleasant things. The scriptures often speak of God's discipline in similar terms. Have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. So these wilderness experiences were accomplishing something in the hearts of God's people. And we ought to give thought to what God is trying to teach us and how he's seeking to grow us in the context of those wilderness moments. The gospel glimpses, you don't need me to point them out. Jesus is the serpent that has been lifted up to bring healing to all who will look to him. Remember the people being bit by the snakes? Moses crafted a bronze serpent, put it on a tall pole, urged the people to look to the serpent in simple faith. And John, the gospel writer in chapter 3, says Jesus is that serpent, lifted up on a pole. For all who will turn to him and look to him will be healed. Jesus is the water from the rock that quenches our true thirst. Jesus is the city of refuge where the guilty can flee for protection. We didn't touch on this, but one of the parameters that God gave was to provide cities of refuge throughout the land. If you were to have killed someone unintentionally, it would be a place to go. It was a way of protecting the vulnerable from vigilante justice and exaggerated retribution, a great theme of refuge. Jesus is the star and the scepter prophesied by Balaam. Balaam ended up giving a whole series of blessings on Israel. And one of the things he said was that out of Israel will rise a star. A bright star will come into the darkness, and out of Judah, the tribe of Judah, will rise a scepter. It's the implement of a king, right? A king will rise out of Judah. Well, Jesus is that star, and he is that scepter who has risen up out of Israel. So a lot of great reminders here of God's grace and the work of Christ as we look here at Numbers.